This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Natasha Mitchell here. Welcome. Have you ever had one of those oddball dreams where you find yourself suspending both gravity and reality and you start to levitate and suddenly you're flying with the birds? In this episode of Science Friction, you're meeting a daredevil who does just that. He's going to try a wild experiment with his own body, and he's chasing a world record.
I always wanted to be a superhero, and that's very hard when you are a chicken, like I am, because superheroes, they always fly, and I'm scared of heights.
This is Mark Hauser, and he's gripped by an obsession. He wants to fly alone, so in the air, without a plane or a glider, and he wants to do it fast.
My passion for flying and wind power has roots in my childhood. I always wanted to fly like a bird. When I started skydiving, I quickly realized that with my size and my weight, I was always fast, flying forward. And in 2012, I set a first world record, 304 kilometers per hour in ground speed without any tailwind. As a next step, I wanted to find out how fast I could fly with a good tailwind. And the best option, of course, would be a hurricane, but hurricanes are more or less suicidal. So the second best option was the jet stream.
Yeah, I'm just not convinced that throwing yourself into the jet stream is any safer than throwing yourself into a hurricane. Oh, taking us into the sky will be my co-pilot for this episode of Science Friction, ABC documentary maker Lynn Gallagher. Now, Lynn is actually a pilot in real life.
Hello. Although, Tash, it has to be said, I'm just a baby pilot. I'm still learning.
So, you want to have a go?
Sure. I just need to think about... Do you want me to play with the rudders and the stick?
Just the stick.
Okay. All right,
So first thing, I'll put the heading bug in the right spot. You see the compass?
Yep.
I've
got the compass. Okay. So we're heading north.
God, what are you flying here, Lynn?
It's a little military jet called a machete. I'm in the back where the rear gunner would sit, and I've never felt so cool and so nauseous all at the same time. People often get sick in these machines. It's just too fast.
Shall I go? Did you vomit?
I may have swallowed.
Oh,
but let's talk about something else.
Can we?
Let's talk about the jet stream. It's kind of like the planet's conveyor belt of the sky. It's what migratory birds and commercial planes use. Mm. It's a high altitude current of air. It moves fast, at least 100 kilometres an hour.
Okay, so birds and planes, the jet stream hitchhikers, but what sort of craziness does it take for a human, in this case Mark, to consider throwing their own body into the jet stream without, you know, a big plane wrapped around them for safety?
It is extreme.
It is very extreme.
And the temperature up there will be minus 40 degrees Celsius. He'll be wearing a thermal protection suit and he'll have his own oxygen. So he's going to head up in a hot air balloon and then jump out of the basket of the hot air balloon into the jet stream.
What, just jump out?
Oh, well, he will have a parachute.
Okay. All right.
So, but he won't open that parachute until he's hit that record-breaking speed that he's aiming for.
Okay, we're talking about 24,000 feet above sea level. And just to give people a sense of what that looks like, that's just under Mount Everest.
Yeah. So it's almost but not quite at the point where you can see the curvature of the Earth.
What about the balloon pilot? Is he okay about going up that high in a, you know?
Yeah, he is. He's
a basket
he's a
with record a balloon on it.
Balloon pilot, balloonist. He's been up that high before and he knows what the limits of the machine are, and this is right on the edge. It's right on the limits of what a balloon like this can do.
Wow. Okay, so you're going to take us ringside to witness in this episode of Science Friction the whole mad trip. Moment by moment.
I'm flying up with another Steve Gale, and he's the one with the little jet fighter plane, the one that we've heard before. We're in the middle of New South Wales in Condobolin, and the locals can't believe that this is happening in their town. It's the night before the big jump, and I want to know what Mark's feeling.
It was quite a bit was last minute planning, and
I think that's usually how it gets at the end. But now we are all ready. And even we can even get a bit of sleep.
Yeah.
As well, yeah.
That's a bonus.
Are you recording already?
Yes, I'm recording. Okay. I think I may be too loud.
The main target, the main goal of the mission is to show the untapped clean energy potential of the jet stream. If you want to attract people for such a subject, you have to make a kind of a stunt, maybe. And I think a kind of a stunt when you have to jump without wings at all, so you jump in a normal suit, then it could maybe attract people to the higher cause. And that's why we are doing it.
We've just wandered into the condo pub at this point.
So what's this higher cause, Lynn, that Mark's talking about, the jet stream being a potential source of energy?
Well, back in his home in Switzerland, there are a number of startup companies that are doing this. They're using the power of the jet stream to produce electricity.
Right, so it's a little bit like how wind turbines would work on Earth, only this is all happening up yonder.
Yes, a bit of both. There's a kite that goes up yonder and then there's a string that comes back down to Earth, and that's where the little turbine is. So the thing is tethered up into the jet stream, and that's why people think it's not very viable and actually quite dangerous. So it's very, very much in the experimental phase. But, you know, I actually think Mark's higher cause might be something else.
So he's like, do you guys want a drink?
I think so, yeah.
Are you nervous?
Yes, sir.
You are nervous? Why didn't you do it so early?
Where
are you jumping from? Out of a plane or?
No, from a hot air balloon.
You have a parachute though, right?
I have, yeah, yeah. I have. Yeah. Yes, I will open the parachute. Otherwise, it would hurt. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I think it will work. Yeah, it must work.
Okay, so as Mark leaves the pub to get a good night's sleep, because it's going to be a mighty early start for you all, what do you reckon this higher cause is, Lynn?
I think it's got to do with human ambition. I think it's got to do with that desire to fly that's completely crazy in a way.
Mm.
Wendy Elford is a pilot and a professional ergonomist, and she designs environments that make people perform at their best. And so she's really interested in aviation. And when I told her this story of Mark Hauser, she told me the story of Harry Hawker.
Harry Hawker was a very famous Australian aviator. In 1914, he figured out that not knowing how to reliably recover from a spin in a light aircraft, and that's called spin recovery, it was basically 100% failure rate at that point. It was 100% fatal. So this was June 1914. He's in Brooklands in a Sopwith tabloid biplane, flying well above the English countryside. He thinks he's going to give this a red-hot shot. So basically freezing winds, hot castor oil against the goggles. It's not great flying conditions if you can't really see what's going on, but Harry's determined to do this. So he does a very slow loop, which he knows is going to stall the aircraft, and he drops into the gyration. There's a wing drop, you know, a couple of turns. This is basically the beginning of the end for most people. And what Harry does, it doesn't work. So here he is spinning towards the ground. In fact, he flies into the ground, but fortunately there's a forest between him and the hard part of the ground. So he does actually land up in hospital, cut and bruised, but alive. But being the determined sort of person he is, Harry decides that 2 days later he's going to hop up in the plane again above the English countryside, and give it another hot shot. So this really is the mark of insanity, but he's pretty determined. So what he does is push the nose down further into the ground. And the last thing you really want to do if you're flying a plane and it's spinning towards the ground is basically push the nose down further into the ground. But it turns out that was the secret to the recovery.
So we all owe a lot to this brave Australian pilot. He put his own body on the line to figure out something fundamental. It's the sort of knowledge that doesn't come any other way. He's doing something utterly contradictory to his own survival instinct. But every pilot goes through this. Wendy Elford herself has been there.
You don't really believe that you can do it. And you hop in the plane, get yourself out to the flying area. You reckon you're good to go, but you're really not. Not mentally, but you should be. That there's this little doubt potentially. But you go along for it because you've actually done that a few times by now. You've done lots of practice stalls and the instructor's been there. So you go ahead and you stall the plane. And then, of course, the next thing is it does go into an incipient spin. And I can remember it starting its first couple of turns towards the ground. And I'm thinking, this is not a good thing. And then the next thought is that you're 100% the only person who can fix that situation. There's no one else in the plane. There's no instructor. You'll do exactly what so many other pilots have done before, and you'll fly the plane into the ground unless you do exactly what you were trained to do. So funnily enough, you throw in your right rudder, you push the stick forward, you sort of centre the rudders again and bring your power back on, and all of a sudden the horizon turns up again, much to your great relief. So I didn't really need to do any more stalls that day, but once you've actually done that, you're in a position to believe that you can do it again. And it did make me feel not invincible, but very much in power of myself. And then the rest of it's really not luck, but circumstances.
So have you had to do that, Lynn? Put yourself into a tailspin and then get out of it?
Yeah. I only did it with an instructor, but I am about to do it on my own. And what I've learned is that taking risks, facing your fear when you're learning how to fly is really important because it helps you cope with unpredictable situations when you do get there.
I mean, Mark isn't really learning how to fly. I mean, he's not learning how to fly in a plane. He's learning how to fly in the sky without a plane. So can we actually compare him to Harry Hawker, do you think?
Well, he is. He's like any pilot. He's trained himself for this moment. He's got specialised equipment. He's done his risk assessment. And now he's going for it.
I tested my own oxygen system in a cold chamber in Switzerland at minus 60 degrees. I trained in a decompression chamber of the Swiss Army to simulate hypoxia symptoms, and we made balloon jumps in Switzerland.
Okay, so it's the morning of the jump in Condobolin. Take us there.
It's dark, it's 5 a.m., cold and tense. We're in the local showgrounds. The ground crew's helping Mark into his oxygen suit. The balloon's there lying on the ground ready to inflate, and Mark's still waiting for a weather report. How are you feeling? I can't really talk to Mark because of his oxygen mask. But he's now in the hot air balloon with the operator, Steve Griffin, and another skydiver, Tom Goulburn. They'll take him up to the height of 24,000 feet. This experiment needs very, very particular weather conditions. High-speed wind at high altitude and little or no wind at ground level because the balloon needs to be able to stop when it lands.
So if the conditions aren't right, Lynn, will they call it all off?
Yes, and that's what's making Mark really nervous.
Mm. still jet stream?
Well, we're still jetty-ish.
Not good.
It's not exactly what we were waiting for, no. It's a... quite the opposite. No winds, but clouds. I think that's real bad news for us.
Right.
You're the lucky guy, you promised.
I promised.
Make a weather dance.
As you can hear, we're weighing up the risks, but it's not black and white. We're talking about shades of grey. You can cope with some things going wrong, but there's always a tipping point. In aviation, they call it the Swiss cheese effect because that's when the holes start joining up and that's when there's a disaster.
Is it a go?
There's nothing saying a million words.
All we can go on is what the information that it tells us. So we can't just make up what we want. We've got to go on what's actually in front of us. But there's a plan there, so at least it looks like we can get a safe landing.
There are people here who think the experiment should be called off, but Mark and his crew are going to go for it. So I'm waving goodbye to the balloon as it takes off.
I can't believe it, they're going.
But our recorders will help us listen in to what happens next.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you.
Woo.
Thank you very much. Radio next.
Yep. Yep. Lovely.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone. Now
we're inside the basket. It's about 40 minutes on, and they're just hitting the jet stream.
How fast are we at?
103.
Sorry?
103.
Oh, that's Jetstream now.
But something's gone wrong. The burners have gone out because of lack of oxygen. It seems like the pilot light's gone out. That's Steve clicking in the background trying to reignite the pilot light. And then to make matters worse, their oxygen supply has started to leak. That's Steve. He's telling Mark to go, go. Mark's climbing out of the basket. They can all panic later, but now they have to survive. And now, Mark's flying. He's stretching himself out into a smooth shape, making himself as flat as he can be. His descent across this dry landscape takes him about 6 kilometres to the next town of Forbes, and then the moment he lands, he's greeted by an unsuspecting farmer in a field of sheep shit, and he posts this message, a voice message to his friends. I'll play it for you.
Hi everyone, I was landing safely, but in the balloon we had a lot of problems, and I hope they could ignite the fire again. The burner went out or down, and at the same time we had problems with the oxygen. So I hope Steve and Tom are fine. I do not see them on the sky, but maybe it's too far away for Mina to see them. I have no idea where they are, so I'm safe on the ground, everything's fine for me, but I worry about the balloon guys.
And the balloon guys are in trouble. They're facing a rocky ride. They're still up high, struggling with the burners.
Could be an exciting ride, Tom.
Sure?
Could be an exciting ride.
But good news. As they descend...
This has been very tense, Lynn.
The burners come back on because there is more oxygen.
So they're okay.
They're down. They're down.
Oh, they're down.
Right. See that? There you go. Welcome back to Earth. Great experience. Oh, man. I should do a Pope's kiss now.
Oh, the relief. So everyone's okay and everyone's landed.
And when I caught up with Mark, this is what he said happened.
We had a hard time in the basket. So it was really, really stressful. And Steve just shouted at me, leave now. And I was leaving like a chicken, like a coward, and leaving my two friends behind. So it was really, it was a nightmare, yeah, to be honest.
The thing is, they were chasing a world record in all this. Let's not forget this. So did Mark manage to go faster than 304 kilometres per hour in the jet stream, given that he just sort of had to get out of that balloon with no real sort of calm planning? He had to just leap out.
Well, true to the occasion, it did take us a while to figure this out, because Mark was carrying 6 GPS devices.
And that helps track the speed.
To help track the speed, 5 of them failed.
Oh, no. What else can go wrong?
They only needed one to work, though. So we all gathered in a cafe and we had to hover around PowerPoints to charge our mobile phones and computers, and we were able to figure out the speed. There we could crunch the numbers.
It was 270. That was just crudely going through the numbers and...
So exactly what did you get?
So the result we got was 270.15 kilometres an hour horizontal speed.
It was good to be in there and to be the first one without wings in a jet stream, but the result was not really overwhelming. So
yeah, disappointing. But
very good speed. And that's horizontal still. If you factor in the vertical component for his total speed across the ground,
it's still in a pretty explosive.
Yeah.
Do they feel like it was a failure?
Well, it's weird because Mark went slower in the jet stream than he did in still air. In still air, he went 304 kilometres an hour. In the jet stream, with a 75-knot tailwind, he went only 270.
So even with a tailwind to his advantage, it didn't work. What was going on, do you reckon?
Well, Wendy Elford's really interesting on this.
When you deal with risk at that level and your own fear, you have to be so focused that you've got ultimate control of all your faculties, full awareness of your operating environment. Situational awareness is key to surviving these situations at the first level and certainly to perform at your best. So he knew when he jumped out that he wasn't going to be in that state. It's highly critical for your performance that you are in control, and he wasn't in control at the time he left the balloon.
But there's still taking risks in the air, and
yes.
I'm just wondering, is there something that can be learnt from an experiment like Mark's?
Oh, absolutely. I do believe, though, that these are like a lot of scientific experiments. When you do something that's really edgy, you do push the knowledge boundary, not just for yourself but for others. You know, the jet stream obviously is going to be a big part of our future experience of flight of all types. And every time you go for a flight, you'll hear the pilot saying, you know, we're going to play with our altitude so we can go faster, catch the tailwind. And Mark's experiment is, how do you fly fast as a human being in the jet stream? That's what he aimed to do. But because when he was forced to jump out, he was so flustered by the circumstances that he left the balloon in that he didn't actually manage to accomplish what he'd intended to do, which was to fly fast in the jet stream. So I think we'll see him up there again, just like we saw Harry Hawker.
And despite Mark and his crew ending up in a genuinely life and death situation, they do say they'd do it again.
Crazy cats.
So you did a phenomenal thing. Everyone's still in one bit. And, there's the possibility of other adventures that great friends made. So I'd follow you on any adventure you plan to do in future.
Okay, perfect.
No problem with it. And I bet you're the same.
Yeah.
Don't care what it is. If I can do something of use, I'll be there.
Perfect. Thank you, guys. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mark was really moved by this offer of support.
So the whole adventure didn't go 100% according to plan. And the question, was it worthwhile? It's hard to tell. Now when everyone is safe in one piece on the ground, I would say, yes, of course. But we were really lucky.
Given that so much went wrong with this experiment, I mean, the burners went out, the oxygen leaked, the GPSs, you know, clapped out, it really does actually sound like luck had a lot to do with even the success that they achieved. I'm imagining this isn't a day that you're going to forget anytime soon. What an adventure.
Absolutely. It was an amazing day. And what struck me about this experiment was that we need people like Mark. We need people like Harry Hawker, because these kind of risk takers do make the world safer for the rest of us, particularly in aviation.
Yes, but you could just construe Mark as being, you know, a classic adrenaline junkie and really not in it for the bigger cause.
He is different from Harry Hawker in that regard, but we still need people like that, and we need people like him. I mean, think of what Mark achieved. He's taught us a lot about human psychology in extreme conditions, about how we might harness our fears and manage stress in diabolical situations. And everyone involved did get to know more about the jet stream. So, you know, maybe one day we will be able to harness that power.
I quite like the sound of that possibility. Hey, great having you as co-pilot on Science Friction this week. Can you come again?
I'll try.
And good luck with the pilot's license. You can catch Lynn's work over on our sister programs, Earshot and the History Listen podcast to subscribe to, along with Science Friction. And don't forget Science Friction Live if you're passing through Melbourne at the Melbourne Museum. It's part of our event series. Next one, November the 1st. It is the future of sex. It will be salacious. Head to our website to book. And thank you to sound engineer Andrew Grant this week. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Talk to me on Twitter at Natasha Mitchell. Flying away. See ya.
So you want to have a go?
1241 speed from the D25 journal.
Sure. I just need to think about, do you want me to play with the rudders and the stick?
Just the stick.
Just the stick. Okay.
All right, I'll... So first thing, I'll put the heading bug in the right spot.
I've got the compass, so we're heading north.
So, I've just moved, seen a little red bug, I'll just wish it left and right. Okay, so right now we're in the right heading. Now, I'm indicating flight number 174, I'll just come up to 175. Okay, there we go. So,